It's a letter from my godfather.
Godfather? Sputtered Uncle Vernon. You haven't got a godfather.
Yes, I have, said Harry brightly. He was my mum and dad's best friend. He's a convicted murderer, but he's broken out of wizard prison, and he's on the run. He likes to keep in touch with me, though. Keep up with my news. Check if I'm happy.
Welcome to the Basic Cinephile Podcast, Season 1, Harry Potter.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Ziana.
And I'm your other host, Adelia. This season on the Basic Cinephile Podcast, we are reading all the Harry Potter books and watching all the Harry Potter movies. And this week, we are kicking off episode 6 with the third movie, The Prisoner of Azkaban.
This podcast contains spoilers. This movie has been out for over 17 years, so we don't feel bad spoiling anything and everything about it. But if you want to watch it first, pause the episode and go read all the books and binge all the movies, because honestly, who knows how many books and movies we will end up referencing in this episode.
Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban was directed by Alfonso Cuarón. The screenplay was written by Steve Kloves, and the music was composed by John Williams. It was nominated for 2 Oscars, Best Original Score and Best Visual Effects.
This movie headed in a different direction than the previous movies. The writer and composer are the same, but the director and shooting locations are new.
The runtime is 2 hours and 22 minutes, which makes it about 20 to 30 minutes shorter than the first two. Did you feel like this movie was shorter to you?
Yeah, it did. The first two felt like they dragged, and we talked about that, but I do feel like, I mean, it still felt long, but it did feel shorter.
Yeah, the pace seemed to be much quicker this movie.
Yes, definitely a faster pace, and it kind of kept the action going the whole time.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So the Sorcerer's Stone had 81% on the tomato meter and an audience score of 82%. The Chamber of Secrets has 82% on the tomato meter and an audience score of 80%. The Prisoner of Azkaban has 90% on the tomato meter and an audience score of 86%. Are you surprised that this is the highest rated film thus far?
Yes, I am. Absolutely. I mean, it's a really fun movie, but there's some stuff it really bothers me.
Yeah, so spoiler alert for the rest of this episode, this is not our favorite movie. We both had a lot of issues with this one.
Yeah, we did.
So I was a little surprised to see that it's like overall widely accepted that this is the best movie in the franchise. And I'm like, ooh, I liked the first and the second movie more than this one.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that statement. This movie has more artistic liberties that are taken for sure. And I don't hate that, but it just isn't done in a way that I necessarily enjoy.
Yeah, definitely not my favorite. But first, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsors for this episode.
Hello there, my fellow Basic Cinephile fan. Jeremy Hirschkorn of Jet Movement Academy here. In my experience as a gym owner and trainer, I've seen the world start to change. You'll need new strategies to keep your health in top condition. That's why I'm offering Jet Online. This is a complete training and coaching package available wherever you have internet access. Go to jetmovement.com to sign up today or contact me at jeremy@jetmovement.com. Wishing you happy listening and amazing health. Keep moving.
So we are going to discuss what was different about this movie, which honestly, it felt like pretty much everything.
Yeah.
This movie felt very different from the first two.
There was a huge departure from the first two movies, definitely.
For sure. So this was the first Harry Potter movie to be released in IMAX.
And you could tell there were a lot of like cinematic moments, these sweeping landscapes that were just grand and would be very beautiful to see in IMAX, but not necessarily relevant to the plot.
And I'm sure that Alfonso Cuarón, the director, and a lot of the more artistic people who were in charge of this film were excited about the IMAX, but I honestly felt like I could just hear the conversations with like the studio executives being like, okay, we're shooting in IMAX, so make sure that this is like really stunning in IMAX. It felt more like a business decision to have all of this B-roll of like the lake and flying over Hogwarts. And a lot of those shots, I was like, this doesn't really have anything to do with the movie.
And I mean, it is filmed largely in Glencoe, Scotland, and they built some new sets and added a clock tower in the courtyard to Hogwarts and expanded Hagrid's hut. Finally. The man deserves it.
If you listened to last week's episode, and if you haven't, definitely go back and listen, we talked about how in this book and in the movie, Hagrid becomes a teacher. And so basically, he gets a whole extra job, like, dumped onto his plate. And we were like, this guy better be getting a raise. Yeah. And also, he, like, give the man some better accommodations. That hut is tiny.
So tiny.
So Alfonso Cuarón obviously heard our inner cries to give Hagrid some more space. Mm-hmm. So the design of Hagrid's hut in this film is basically, like, twice the size of the first two.
Which is great. And I feel like because of these new sets and because Scotland is like gorgeous, mm-hmm. that's why they were like, let's make this IMAX. Let's justify spending this big budget on all these new spaces. And yeah, it felt like a business transaction of like, look, here is the lake. Look, here is mountains. Oh, let's see the train.
And they are super cool. I went to Glencoe a couple years ago. And I was traveling Scotland by myself, and honestly, like, a bunch of the spots that I wanted to go see were all Harry Potter related.
Yeah.
And I still didn't even see half the stuff that I wanted to see. But Glencoe is stunning on its own. So it makes sense that if you're going to be shooting in IMAX, this movie really, it did a lot more filming on location versus, like, in a studio. So that makes sense. But I don't know. For me, it kind of took me out of the movie in a way. Like, it is gorgeous, but there was a lot of shots where I was just like, you're just doing this so that it looks cool in IMAX.
Yeah, I would say that one, like, very defining moment of when it feels like we're filming in IMAX is the conversation that Lupin and Harry have about, I used to know your mom and dad, and I was...
Yeah.
And it's like, we're going to be on a bridge. We're going to have this deep heart-to-heart on a bridge, and we're going to, like, shoot it from far away so we can see this giant bridge and then, like, come in closer and be like, oh,
yes,
here we are, which didn't feel natural at all. Like, if you're in a classroom and if you're, you know, fighting the Dementors and or learning how to fight the Dementors, then that makes sense. But you're not, like, hanging out outside of the classroom. Like, if it were maybe Hagrid, it would make sense because they're outdoors. They go do things with Hagrid. But he doesn't do that with Lupin.
No, and it just seemed, yeah, it seemed like all of those, like, little conversations, they're like, okay, let's move it outside. Let's have it be in a better location. It felt a little unnecessary, and it felt forced.
Yeah.
It didn't feel organic to me to have as many of those shots, like those wide sweeping shots, as they had. But for this movie, they brought in a new director. They brought in Alfonso Cuarón, and he, you might be familiar with his work. He's directed Gravity, Roma, and A Little Princess, and like a bunch of other movies. Mm-hmm. So he's a super talented director. They wanted to go in a different direction with this movie. So the overall goal was to have like a darker tone and have it be a little bit more of a cinematic experience. So I do think he definitely delivered that. But I found this to be kind of interesting. So when he was originally like in talks of possibly directing this film, he was having a conversation with another super famous Mexican director, which is Guillermo del Toro, who you might know from Pan's Labyrinth and The Shape of Water. So Alfonso Cuarón was talking to Guillermo del Toro, and he was like, hey, you know, I might try and get a Harry Potter movie. And he kind of tried to downplay it, like, oh, I don't know, like, don't judge me, trying to go for this really, like, commercial property. And I guess Guillermo del Toro, in very colorful language, basically told him, like, are you kidding me? Do you understand how big of a deal this is? And he was like, well, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I know they're, like, really famous books and whatever. And Guillermo del Toro was like, have you read any of them yet? And he was like, no. And he was like, okay, you need to go read these books right now. Like, stop talking to me. Go to a bookstore, get the books, and read it. And basically, like, you're an idiot if you don't take this project. I just thought that that was really funny. Like, he had this super famous director being like, are you kidding? You're not too good for Harry Potter. What are you talking about? This is Harry Potter. So he went, read the books, and was like, oh my God, these are incredible. And then the rest is history.
I mean, they are. And I, as someone who kind of was hesitant about starting to read Harry Potter or even, like, watch them, And I thought it was just like, oh, witches and wizards, like, And I was completely wrong, obviously. I'm doing a podcast about it now. It has deeply influenced my life. And so I could see if you didn't really have a frame of reference for it, and they were like, you want to do this wizard movie? And you're like, no, I don't. I would rather do something that's a little more mind-bendy or artistic or all this stuff. But really, I mean, Harry Potter is a whole different world, so you can be incredibly creative and artistic with it.
And for sure. And you were so hesitant to start reading the books, and you were like 10 years old, and you were already like, I don't know, I might be too cool for this. This is a grown man.
Yeah.
Who's like, why would I want to read a kid's book about wizards?
And I mean, he is a very talented director, so it's not as if he has all this excess time, I would assume, where he's just like, oh, let me just read for leisure, you know?
Oh, yeah, and the books are massive.
And you're committing to a whole series.
Yeah.
It's not just a one and done.
Yeah.
You got to go full in it. You can't just be like, oh, so I might direct the third movie and just like start at the third. No.
Okay. Well, actually, he did.
Oh.
So he went out. He read the third book first and loved it. And then he was like, okay, I got to go back and read the other two. So then he read the first one, and then he read the second one, and then he read the third one again. And then at that point, I think the books were only up to book four.
Okay.
So then he also went out and read the fourth book and was like, yeah, these are amazing and I'm hooked. But I do think that that's funny. He's like, okay, well, this is the one they want me to direct, so I guess I'll read it. And he probably enjoyed it, but I'll also probably super confused.
Yeah, I mean, they do always do a recap at the beginning of the book, and that's one of our critiques, is that just like every book, it's like, Harry Potter was a wizard. He wasn't a normal boy.
Yeah.
And you're like, who needs this recap?
Yeah,
I guess
the directors of the movies.
Yeah, that's who needs it. J.K. Rowling is just out here doing the most for the directors.
Now we know. But so I guess for this one, they told Alfonso Cuarón basically that they wanted the theme of the book to come through, the essence, the vibe of the book to come through, more so than like a literal translation of the book to film. They were like, yeah, you can kind of skip some stuff or, you know, kind of tweak some things if you need to, because again, the books are so long. It's like, we can't make a book or a movie that includes everything from the book.
Yeah, that's impossible.
Yeah. So I think that that really contributed to the overall film, where we were like, wow, a lot is different. The first two movies really do like stick to the book pretty closely. This one, not so much, but that's what they told him to do.
And I would say that that's not like the biggest bone that I have to pick with this movie.
No.
I would say the thing that bothered me the most was the costuming and the makeup. It was really bothersome that like they're just running around in muggle clothes. Like, that's not a normal thing for them. You know, Ron has to like put on muggle clothes. Hear this whole backstory of like, oh, here are all these wizards that don't know how to dress like muggles. So why would these kids just be running around in low rise jeans and, you know, cargo shorts or pants? And that doesn't make sense. Maybe on their trip to Hogsmeade, would that be okay? But after lessons, you're not just like changing into your clothing. Like, you're wearing your uniform. This is a British school. This is, you know, you're gonna be in uniform.
Yeah. No, they definitely made a lot of those changes, but I guess it like didn't necessarily affect the plot, but it definitely affected our personal viewing.
Yeah.
But do we want to talk about what we liked about the film?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's do that. I mean, I do love the opening scene. Like, it does feel like the most grand out of all of them, where he's like, Lumos Maxima, and like the whole screen turns, you know, like so bright that you can't see anything else. And then I love the first part of the book, and I love the first part of the movie. And he did such a good job of Marge blowing up. Aunt Marge,
she blows up and she starts floating away, and you've got like Vernon jumping up and trying to grab her, and
Ripper just like going after him. And
that was a perfect opening.
And that Dudley is like unaware of what's happening for so long until like he gets hit in the head with one of Aunt Marge's buttons.
Yeah.
And then the end of it is like Vernon screaming to the skies and just Dudley going back to watching TV.
Yeah.
Like, I just think that that's so funny and wonderful.
So I think they did a really good job of that.
I loved the opening scene. And they do, they go to this like grander scale. So you end up with like this really wide shot of the sky and this little tiny Aunt Marge just like floating away.
Yeah.
And that for me, I'm sure that looked super cool in IMAX. And that doesn't feel forced. Mm-hmm. That felt very natural. It felt like part of the story. And so I did enjoy kind of the scale of that opening sequence.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And then another thing that I loved is how they showed time passing in this movie with the season changing of the Whomping Willow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see it shaking its leaves and then like, you know, growing new leaves back in spring or like shaking off snow for winter. Like, I just thought that was like really fun and cute and like a way to like really include the fact that like the Whomping Willow is a very, you know, central part of this plot in the end.
For sure. If you were someone who didn't read the books, but you were watching the movies, you'd be like, oh, okay, this is a cool tree. And then at the end be like, oh, and it's like super important. And we see the Whomping Willow in the second movie too. But this one, yeah, you get all four of the season changes. So it plays more of a central role throughout the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that was cool. And I feel like it was a really cool visual way to point out how time is such a central theme to this film. And later you get the time changer or time turner. And
you have the addition of the clock tower.
Yeah. You've got all these like really strong visual representations of time. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that was a really good way to do that for film.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And then we also, this is like a love, but like kind of a dig at the movie too. So we loved Gary Oldman's acting.
He's incredible. He's an incredible actor.
Hot take, Gary Oldman's a great actor.
Yeah, and he did convey Sirius's madness, like,
the scene where he like transforms from the dog into Sirius Black in the Shrieking Shack. He does such a good job. Like, you really feel like this guy has been living as an animal for decades.
Yeah, he is feral.
And he's like trying to become human again. He did such an amazing job. But he doesn't look scary. He doesn't look anything like the description from the book. I don't know. I just like didn't buy it. Like, even then, I'm like, he's such a good actor, but like, I don't know. He didn't look that scary.
And that's where I feel like they kind of didn't do the costuming and makeup correctly. Mm-hmm. Because you have the ability to turn Ralph Fiennes?
I would say Fiennes. I don't know how you actually say it.
Sorry. You turn him into Voldemort. You know, like, you have the capabilities of doing that.
Yeah, but
you
can't make no nose.
You can't make Gary Oldman look like more sallow and like also a little bit younger, and his hair should be longer and mangier, and you know, like,
that was the thing. He should have been like in his mid 30s and he looked like he was in his mid 40s. And then the tattoos that are all over his body, like, they didn't look like menacing or like intimidating. They just kind of looked like when you're in fourth grade and you take a marker and you like sneak from your parents and you're trying to be hardcore and you draw all over your body. That's kind of what it looked like.
And also, this is a wizard prison where it like sucks your soul out of it. Like, you're not trying to pass the time in prison. You're not out here like getting jacked and like getting prison tattoos.
I don't think you can like, get prison tattoos in Azkaban.
Yeah, Bellatrix isn't out here giving Sirius Black.
I think they're all in solitary.
You know? Yeah.
So
it makes no sense. Why would he do this? So unless he had these tattoos prior to going to Azkaban, there is no reason for him to have
tattoos.
And
they just look stupid.
They look so dumb.
Okay, but a couple more things that we actually did like. The grounds were really pretty.
Hot take, Scotland.
Scotland, gorgeous. Who knew? And we also really enjoyed the darker tone that this movie takes. And I feel like this is kind of the first chapter in the rest of the movies. And they just kind of progressively get a little darker.
Yeah. And I do feel like their goal was to kind of become a little bit more of like a pop culture phenomenon.
Rather, and they accomplished that.
They did it. It just might not have personally been my style, but I can respect that you are trying to cross over into a wider audience with this movie. So, I mean, kudos to them for that. But again, there's always a caveat for that for me. But yeah, the tone being darker, love that. And I mean, it is getting darker. It's enjoyable.
Yeah, the story itself. Yeah, the book gets darker and the movie gets darker. And they did a good job of that. All right, so we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors for this episode.
Changed the game just now. I have a rave.
These are the best ideas I've ever heard.
Seth Rogen can't
I'm saying that that's the commentary that will exist.
A Barbie girl in a Barbie world.
Defiled Mickey Mouse. Venom, 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 venom,
venom, venom, venom. Oh my God!
Listen to new episodes weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
You ready to go off?
Yeah, I have been waiting for this moment the entire time, and I haven't held it in at all.
No, our section about what we liked about the movie, half of it was like, man, but we didn't like this. So, guys, we're going to talk about what we didn't love about this movie.
Okay, let's just start with the Dementors.
Yes.
I like the graphics of it, so I guess I could have gone with that as something that I liked.
Visually, they do look exactly how I would picture a Dementor to be.
Yeah. But why is everything freezing?
Like, yeah.
They come close and just, like, ice shows up. And I get that they're, like, trying to make it seem, like, more doomy and gloomy. But, like, you could just, like, do that with the color of the screen, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So they're lighting. Definitely, they're going with that theme of how do we visually portray a being that sucks all these invisible things. So it's like you're sucking away happiness. You're sucking away joy. You're sucking away laughter, and instead you're making people just feel really depressed.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the usage of them like having everything kind of ice over, frost over, that creates some problems for me. Because I'm like, then wouldn't Azkaban be like a freaking ice castle?
Yeah, and...
And everyone would
die? They are humans, so it's not as if they're just going to be able to live in ice. Years and years and years.
Wizards, without access to their wand, they cannot perform magic. Yeah, they're gonna all die of hypothermia.
Yeah.
So that just, like, didn't work for me. And also, it felt, again, a little forced with these, like, big, grand shots of, like, ooh, everything is, like, slowly icing over. Now it's, like, this whole pond is iced over and the entire Hogwarts Express is iced over. And I was like, oh, my God, can we just... Move it along.
Or, like, let's start out and see, like, some grass. And, like, here are these beautiful flowers that are now iced over and dead. And,
dead.
You know,
they're
like,
all dying.
And we're going to start there and we're going to pan over here and see the lake. And we're going to see, you know, really far away. It just, yeah, it was so unnecessary.
I was like, we get it. They're Dementors. They're not
happy. It took up
a
lot of time. I think you could have saved 20 minutes off of the playtime.
For sure. And, I mean, you just look at the Dementor. I think we're going to understand that, like, these are not happy creatures. These are hostile creatures. They look like dead corpses flying through the air with tattered robes. There's nothing about that that makes me scream, I bet those guys are happy.
And these are trained professional actors. I think that they can convey that they are no longer happy and having a great time when the Dementors come around without this visual effect.
Definitely. And... So in the book, it talks about how every time that Harry gets near the Dementors, he always ends up fainting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because he hears this scream. And then as he's exposed to Dementors more and more throughout the book, it's like he gets to hear more of this audio. And you find out he is hearing Voldemort killing his mother.
The scream of Lily Potter is what he hears.
Yes.
And so he's like, did you hear that screaming? And like in the movie, it's like...
They don't do
like,
it.
What?
They don't do the screaming. Yeah, they don't do the screaming in the movie. They do like a weird...
It's like a whistly, like, it sounds like a train, maybe, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's nothing about this that says, like, this is a woman who's trying to protect her son.
No. And in the book, by the end, the last time he hears a Dementor, or one of the last times, he literally hears, like, a conversation between his mom and Voldemort of, like, no, not Harry.
Yeah.
And then Voldemort basically taunting her. So that, to me, is a very concrete, obvious way to portray what is happening inside of Harry's head. And I feel like they were like, no, we don't want to do that, but we do want to just encase everyone in ice.
Yeah.
Which... Like, what?
It just doesn't make sense.
I don't know.
Just have this kid pass out more.
Yeah. I guess people liked it, obviously, because people like this movie. But we're not people, I guess.
No. And Another thing, when Sirius and Harry are at the lake and mm-hmm. they're like, about the Dementors are coming, trying to suck Sirius's life out of him, and all of a sudden the Patronus appears, blah, blah, blah. But there are like 200 Dementors.
Oh, an excessive amount of Dementors. A horde, a murder of Dementors.
Yeah, they're just all like floating in. They've got this whole gang of Dementors come in for this one guy. And I just have to imagine that like there weren't that many Dementors stationed at a school. You know, they said there's one like that's by the front gate, so then they like can't even get into the Hogwarts grounds, and then like eventually they let them on Hogwarts grounds, and so what, like 2-3 maybe?
Okay, like, I guess I pictured more than that. I probably pictured like 15 Dementors, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe I'm just even saying, like, more. But I mean, I swear this is like,
they're like 60. 200 is a bit much, but like at least 50 Dementors come in their way.
Too many for you to be able to eyeball it and count.
Yeah. And that just feels so excessive. And there's just one after another after another. And they're like swooping in at different times. Like, I just feel like if this is like a predatory type animal, like if you have the opportunity to suck the soul out of someone, like you're not going to be like, yo, hey, let me pass this off to my other Dementor. And then, you know, another one's coming in for this.
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
It would be like, no, I'm getting this all myself. I'm going to do the Dementor's kiss.
Yeah. If we're following the laws of the animal kingdom, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
At all. So yeah, that was, and also Harry, it's pretty advanced magic for him to even learn the Patronus spell. And so for him to be able to even get one Dementor to leave is kind of like
a big deal.
Impressive, right? Mm-hmm. And then in the book, he gets a group of Dementors to leave. And you're like, okay. But like, yeah, the amount of Dementors that he gets to leave in the movie, I'm like, I feel like you'd have to be like Dumbledore to be able to get that to happen.
And Dumbledore would like have trouble with it.
Yeah, it would still be an impressive feat. That would be one of those things where you're like, oh, this is why he's the greatest wizard of our age. Because mm-hmm. he can do that.
And then I would have to wonder, like, how many Dementors are at Azkaban then?
Yeah.
Like, do you have just, like, 400 Dementors just swarming around all the time? Like, that seems
And again, excessive. If they're all encased in ice, there's, Azkaban is a death sentence.
Yeah.
So, yeah, mm-hmm. that was one of the things that we didn't love so much about this one. Another thing, Edie already kind of brought it up, but the costuming choices, they went in a very different direction with the wardrobe and costuming for this movie. So in the first two movies, every time they're at school, they're in school uniforms, which anyone who's ever worked at a private school, gone to a private school, or walked past children who go to a private school, you know that you have to wear a uniform.
Yeah, you get written up or sent home for not wearing a uniform. And I just don't foresee Hogwarts as a place where it's like, hey, just take all this artistic liberty in your personal fashion choices.
Yeah, but in this movie, yeah, they're all in Muggle clothes. And
all the time. All of the time.
When they're going to class, when they're going to Hogsmeade, which Hogsmeade is a wizarding village, so no one there would have regular Muggle clothes either. And most of the kids who are going to Hogwarts are going to be coming from wizarding families, mm-hmm. so they're not going to know the trends.
No, and it wouldn't be trendy in the wizarding world.
No.
Like, Draco Malfoy is going to avoid all non-magical folk at all costs. Oh, for sure,
that's going to be beneath him. Yeah. I didn't even think
about
that.
They're not, like, going into London proper and, you know, taking a ride on this, like, the tube. That's not something that they're doing. So I just don't get why all of a sudden they would be wearing these normal clothes.
No, and it dates the film. I feel like when it first came out, they probably thought it was really cool to have them all in jeans. And I read something, and I don't remember where I read it, but so the costuming for this, they're like, okay, since they're at school, there would still be like some kind of a dress code for this. So if you watch it, you'll notice like they're not wearing any graphic tees. There's no logos. There's no brand names. There's no nothing. They just went really plain. But it just means that everyone in the movie is wearing jeans, some kind of a plain t-shirt, and some kind of a plain zip-up hoodie. This is like the most boring wardrobe of all time. None of it is trendy. And the worst part of this whole movie are the low-rise, loose-fitting pants that they forced Hermione to wear.
Yeah, and I mean, we just recently found some, you know, photos that popped up of us at during that time frame, and everyone in this group photo is wearing ill-fitting low-rise jeans. But I want more for Hermione Granger. You have a whole team of people that could alter these to make them fit better. And I mean, like, Daniel Radcliffe is wearing these like giant cargo pants, and here's the thing, he only gets Dudley's hand-me-downs, so where is he getting these muggle clothes? He would be in these like giant khaki pants that don't fit him at all, or like this giant shirt. Like, nothing would fit him,
and he would only have like two or three pairs of pants and a couple shirts. He's not going to have a lot. And there's nowhere for them to go shopping. There's no regular muggle clothes store in Hogsmeade. They don't have that in Diagon Alley. And no one in Harry's family is dropping him off at a mall with money and telling him to get clothes. So yeah, it was a weird choice. I felt like they were trying to, I don't know, like kind of modernize the franchise, I guess, and be like more relatable to the culture of the time. But again, it just... now it kind of dates it when you go back and watch, because you're like, those clothes aren't really in style anymore, and it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, and I mean, I remember like being the basically the same age as Hermione at the time of this film, and I had friends that were like, oh my gosh, I need, you know, her outfits. They like would go, they got like the
really
like a pink zip up hoodie and stuff, where it's like they wanted to be like Hermione. And I mean, like, in the next film, you know, the Yule Ball dress, like, that became iconic.
The Yule Ball dress is gorgeous. But her clothes, I mean, I feel like I did dress like her, but unintentionally, just because I lived every day in jeans and a hoodie for 6 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was very basic.
Yeah.
But, like, they would get stuff intentionally like Hermione, and they got, like, the Time Turner necklace and, like, you know.
What?
Would make that like their fashion choice for the day. And it just, again, wasn't anything like special. So
no,
I just
it was it was like the most plain clothing you could get at Old Navy is what it looks like they got the entire wardrobe for the cast.
Which is why it bothers me that you couldn't have spent that extra time on Gary Oldman, like, giving him a better costume. I mean, like, you've already, like, solidified Minerva and, you know, Snape and Dumbledore, all these people that, like, you didn't change the fashion at all. I'm pretty sure that they probably had, like, three of the exact same outfits for Hagrid.
Yeah.
And then they just, like, rotated that through. However, there is a moment where Hagrid is skipping stones in the lake after Buckbeak's trial, and the man is wearing a tie, and it straight up is just this super wide, short, weird-looking tie with, like, felt shapes just glued to it. It looks so tacky and cheap, and, like, it pulled me out of the moment.
I forgot about it. Yeah, because if you're a wizard, they talk about this a lot in the books, where the things that they would wear, you're like, oh, that doesn't really make sense. But it's because they don't understand. So it's like, I think at one point someone shows up in like giant galoshes that like go up to your thigh. So basically you're ready to go wade in a river and go fly fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Like they wore that. And then like
somebody wore in the next book, someone wears a kilt and a poncho.
Yes.
And they're like, yeah, these are muggle clothes.
Yeah, so they don't understand. So you're like, okay, that makes sense that you'd, like, picked out these random things that, you know, we know as muggles do not go together. Those are fashion faux pas. They don't understand. What doesn't make sense, yeah, is to buy a tie and then decide to embellish it yourself with felt. It looks like someone cut out felt shapes and hot glued it to a tie.
Yeah,
it's hideous. It doesn't look like something a wizard would wear. It doesn't look like something you could buy in a muggle shop.
Oh, that was custom.
Yeah.
That's not like a tacky thing that you picked up that like nobody wants. Like, where it's like, oh, it's a tie that has a fish on it.
Yeah.
And you're like, ooh, most people aren't going to wear that. But Hagrid's like, a fish. Yeah, awesome.
I feel like some intern in the costuming department had to make that by hand.
I feel like, what, did his kid have a like project that they did at like preschool, and they were like, wear this to work, dad, and like, okay, kid, like,
okay, I guess I will. Yeah, that was horrible. Also, the costuming for Lupin was horrible. Again, Lupin is supposed to be like in his mid-30s, because these guys, remember, James and Lily were really young when they had Harry. They were like 21 or something like that.
Yeah.
So these guys are still fairly young. Like, I'm going to be in my mid-30s in like 2 years, and I better not be looking like Lupin was looking in this movie.
Well,
he looked old, and then he also didn't look sick. Like, he's supposed to look like someone who is visibly ill, and his clothes are supposed to be very tattered, and instead they just cast like an older actor and frumped him up, and they're like, this is fine. But yeah, he didn't really like look sick. He just looked like he had no style.
Yeah, he didn't look haggard in the way that you would if you were chronically turning into a werewolf your entire life every month.
Yeah,
you know, like, it didn't work for me. Do better.
No.
Another thing that I like really hated, they changed Tom in the Leaky Cauldron, this film, and they made him into just like this hunchback, like not necessarily, like
they kind of went for this circus freak vibe for the entire Leaky Cauldron. It's got weird, you kind of feel like you're in like a haunted fun house. Like, the doors are at an angle and everything's creaky, and it seems like things are kind of like the walls are almost moving. Yeah. And then Tom is this character who's got a hunchback, and he walks around kind of like he's disabled, but then he plays this character that like feels kind of offensive.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with the plot, nothing to do with the story. And it's weird. And in the, I think it's the first movie, he meets Tom for the first time.
Yeah, and he's just this normal...
It's a completely different actor.
And I mean, that's part of Voldemort's story, is that he goes to the Leaky Cauldron for the first time and meets somebody else named Tom.
Yeah.
Because his name is Tom, and he's like, I hate being so common. Here's this bartender named Tom. Like,
oh, I forgot about that part. Yeah.
So it just, it did feel like really offensive, and totally took him from being like a fully complete character that just like is a supporting character into this like freak show. But they like didn't give him enough to be like, oh, he's a banshee, or he's a you know, a different creature. Like, they didn't give him that.
He still seemed like he was a wizard. And the whole vibe of the Leaky Cauldron, again, a weird circus freak funhouse kind of vibe, and it just, I didn't buy it. I'm like, this is supposed to be like kind of a central hub for wizards who are going to Diagon Alley. So the way that it's portrayed in the first two movies is how I always pictured it, like a very homey British pub with like a lot of wood, and you can sit at a table or you can sit at booths, and it's like, this place has probably been here for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it just feels like your neighborhood pub. And then in this movie, you're like, this place is straight up scary. Like,
yeah, nobody wants to sleep here. Wizards don't want to
hang out there. No.
Yeah, it didn't feel cozy at all.
Didn't like it.
List it.
I'm listing it.
Another thing I hated was they changed the common room entrance to like, to where the staircase, you know, just all of a sudden moves to this one, like, what, like 4x4 square foot, like,
oh yeah, we've talked about this before, that the moving staircases, the way they do it in the movies is really annoying, that it's like one giant room and then you've got like 87 different staircases that are just constantly moving. Yeah. And then the way they did the common room entrance into this one, it's like the stairs right in front of it could always move, and it looks like maximum you could cram like 15 students in front of the entrance if that staircase decided to move.
Yeah.
So it just makes no practical sense to have that be your entrance.
When like Neville gets locked out of the common room all the time for not knowing the password, and he's like said to just like be sleeping in front of there, you know, nobody would be there. You get stepped on. You're literally in the like main area of traffic, because there's another staircase that will just like lead to another area.
It's so exposed, and the entrances to the common rooms are supposed to be kept secret from all of the other houses, and this is the most like obvious spot. So I'm like, unless this is just a whole wing of the castle that the other houses never go to, this secret entrance would be found out in like 5 seconds by first year students who've never even been to Hogwarts before.
Yeah, they just will be like, oh, have you seen the moving staircases? No, let's go over there. Oh, wait, that's all the Gryffindors. Oh, and it's opening. Okay, that must be where the common room is. Like, it just...
No, it was trash. It was a change that didn't need to happen and then made no sense. Another change that they made that made no sense to me. In the book, we've got Sirius Black, who is kind of wandering around Hogwarts as a dog, trying to A, protect Harry from Peter Pettigrew, and B, trying to meet Harry and see him, because, you know, he's excited to see his best friend's son. And so he goes to one of the Quidditch games, like, as a dog, because he loves sports. Homeboy's been locked up for 20 years or whatever. He's excited to go watch a Quidditch game, and he goes and watches the game. In the movie, they don't have Sirius show up, but they have this dog-shaped cloud just float across the sky.
Yeah, as like lightning is like lightning strikes, and then there's this Grimm in the sky, and I'm like, the whole point of this isn't that there's like a Grimm being shown, it's that Sirius, who looks like a Grimm, is there. Like, I don't understand this. And then the Dementors come. Also in that scene, we get the old Cedric Diggory that they're playing against. And he gets struck by lightning.
An unnecessary addition to this scene.
Nobody needed that.
He would be dead. Injured? Something. Yeah.
He's not catching the snitch after getting struck by lightning.
It's so heartless. They strike him with lightning. And then I don't think they tell you anything else about him for the rest of the movie. It's just like, well,
here's this kid that was flying, all of a sudden gets struck by lightning.
And I'm like, yeah, it's a magical community, but they also, like, lightning is still lightning at Hogwarts.
That doesn't change.
Yeah, that the wizarding world can do magic, but yeah, you can still drown as a wizard. You can still starve as a wizard. Like, basic physical laws of nature still exist.
Yeah. Gravity still exists. I mean, you might be able to, like, do...
You have spells that can kind of counteract it. But, yeah, if you just get straight up struck by lightning, that's going to do something to your body.
Yeah.
And maybe again, it's that he wasn't grounded because he's flying through the air.
You're not grounded, but, like...
I don't know how that works. Anyways,
it's still going to be painful.
It just didn't need to happen. No. But I think they were like, ooh, you know what would look really cool in IMAX? Lightning. Yeah.
Unnecessary.
Unnecessary.
Another unnecessary thing is the scene where Harry learns about Sirius Black being his godfather. So in the book, they're at the, is it Three Broomsticks? Three Broomsticks. And,
in
you
Hogsmeade.
Know, they're, Ron and Hermione are sitting there having their drinks, and then like a couple tables over, you have the Minister of Magic and Minerva and Flitwick and Hagrid, they're all sitting there drinking. It's going to be alcoholic. It's their day off too.
Yeah, teacher's day off.
And then the bartender, Madame Rose Merida, comes over and, you know, like, Hagrid is the bonding glue of that group. You know, everybody's talking, having this conversation, and then, you know, it flows naturally into this, like, oh, Sirius Black, we've got the Dementors, and, oh, so... You want to know something crazy? This is Harry's godfather, and everyone is totally blindsided by this. Fudge is the one to tell them, and nobody else knows. In this movie, Harry, like, puts on his invisibility cloak, follows Minerva, Rose Merida, and Fudge. And this is, like, the only time that Madame Rose Merida is, like, ever centrally in the movies. So it's weird. And they go to like this upstairs room that is an office area type thing, sit down, and Minerva's like, it's crazy. Sirius Black is Harry's godfather. And you're like, so Minerva knew about this the entire time, and you're just hanging out casually with the Minister of Magic? Like, that doesn't track. Like, none of this felt real. And Rose Merida would be working, you know?
Yeah.
I'm owner of this bar. And I'm going to be downstairs making sure that everything's going right.
Yeah, practically nothing about that scene made sense. It's like the three of them don't seem like they'd be friends. And if they were to end up at a table together, it's like, yeah, that would be something where you're hanging out and everyone just kind of trickled in and you end up like, oh, hey, pull up a seat, whatever. Like it happens in the book. This is like the three of us are here. Let's go talk. Let's go to this
room.
For this
very specific
reason.
And
then let's launch straight into this super specific, important conversation.
Yeah, there's no lead up to it.
No nuance whatsoever.
In which case, you could have this conversation anywhere. Hey, I'm going to corner you in a hallway and tell you Harry's Godfather is Sirius Black.
Yeah. Like, it just felt forced. I mean, I guess we're nitpicking on that one, but it just...
It was weird.
It was just like they changed it and they didn't make it like easier to film, you know, and then it works not as well. So it was like, why change it and make it worse?
Yeah. And then, I mean, like if we're getting towards the end of the movie, I mean, I liked the Whomping Willow and all that. And,
yeah.
You know, is it my favorite graphic of a werewolf? No, but like, I'm fine with that. Whatever.
No, Fenrir Greyback, mm-hmm. he ends up looking way more like what I expected werewolf to look like.
I would definitely agree with that. And that's a man who has embraced his inner werewolf. I mean,
you could argue that he's hot. And I don't necessarily think so, but I'm just saying, like, he looks human enough where it's like, you can kind of, I don't know, you can see how this was a human, but like what Lupin transforms into is like...
Like, yeah, it's
giant greyhound that's a werewolf. Like, it's the whole shape of it is weird and skinny and
it's odd. Strange. Yeah, I don't love that. And then, so I did like the Whomping Willow scene and like them going into the shrieking shack. Wow.
The shrieking track?
Say that 10 times fast. No, and I love seeing Peter Pettigrew come into a human form.
His casting is perfect.
Excellent. And I mean, again, all of James's friends are like looking haggard and 45 plus.
Way too old. Yeah.
Yeah, just way too old. But like Peter, at least he fits
the
bill.
Looks like a rat.
Yeah, he really does. And that's probably where it ends, where I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ending scene is just god awful.
It is unforgivable.
Harry gets a new broomstick because his got smashed by the Whomping Willow.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody comes and sees him unwrapping, like, oh my gosh, whoa, let's go out and have you try it out. And Harry gets on it and looks like he's never ridden a broomstick before and goes like 400 miles an hour.
He looks like Neville on this thing. He's like shaky. He looks like he's going to fall off. He's completely out of control. This thing launches him into space, basically. He's just flying across the lake. He's, completely out of control. He's up super high.
And then they just blur his face and he just like, that's it.
Yeah.
And he's going really fast over a lake. Whoa. And I feel like that was the ending of like, let's make it IMAX.
That was the IMAX shot where they're like,
he's going to fly over and he's going to fly over the lake and let's end it. He's going fast. Okay.
And it was so stupid. And it was like, the reason this kid got such a nice broom is because he's actually good at Quidditch.
Yeah. And it's going to go fast, but it's not like a 0 to 1,000 right off the bat. You're going to like... be able to go slower or faster depending on how you ride it. I mean, it's like a wizarding vehicle.
Yeah.
So, like, I can get in my car and I can go 5 miles an hour to begin, you know, like...
It was just a stupid shot. And again, yeah, it really felt like they were just trying to capitalize on the IMAX, which is fine. Give us these beautiful, large, wide shots. That's fine. But don't manufacture them in a way that feels completely inauthentic to the story.
Yeah. So I don't know how this has the highest rating so far.
No.
I do see how it became like a pop culture phenomenon more so than the other two, but like the other two were very much involved
My current ranking is definitely Chamber of Secrets is my favorite so far, then The Sorcerer's Stone, and then Prisoner of Azkaban is my least favorite of the movies so far.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So I guess we disagree with the other critics out there and with the people, because they also seem to love this one.
Yeah, I don't get it. I'm probably not going to watch that movie again for a very long time.
No, I'm skipping that one for sure. But if you guys feel differently, which I'm sure some of you do...
Because we're not part of the 92% or whatever who love it.
We are in the minority.
So
be sure to follow us on Instagram @TheBasicCinephile, on TikTok @TheBasicCinephile, on Twitter at the Basic Cinef1, that's Cinephile without the ILE, and then the number one, and the Basic Cinephile on Facebook, and interact with us. Go off. If you love this one, like, let me know. I mean, do it nicely because my mental health is fragile at the moment, but yeah, let me know why this one is actually great.
Yeah, I love a nice, like, good-natured heckle.
Yeah.
So, like, please just be like, this is my favorite.
Stand up here's for why. Your movie if you love it.
And I mean, that's what being a basic cinephile is just finding what you like and everybody else can hate it and be like, this is why I like it.
That's fine.
Yeah. This movie sucks. I love it.
Yeah.
And this movie, super beloved, didn't like it. I said what I said.
Not for me. Not for me. I think that's pretty much everything we had to say about this book, right?
Yeah.
Or movie. Sorry. Not book.
Love the book.
Love the book.
Movie.
For the movie. So like I said, be sure to follow us, The Basic Cinephile, on social media. And then be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We put out new episodes every Thursday. And you can rate the podcast now on Spotify. Ooh. That's a fancy new feature. So please, if you have 2 seconds to spare today, be sure to leave us a rating on Spotify and leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. We super appreciate it. And we'll see you guys next Thursday.